Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding, and I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we have an old school bodybuilder who had a great physique. His name is John Araneta, and John was one of the top bodybuilders in the 1980s. He took second place at the Nationals in the middleweight class two times, once to John Natashak in 1984, and the second time to Lee Labrada in 1985. And he won the middleweight class at the MPC USA in 1987, the year Mike Quinn won the overall. So John had a phenomenal physique. He was trained by Rory Liedelmeyer, who's definitely one of the best physiques in the country. And it's a shame that he never got his pro card, but he quit the sport kind of early. So we're going to talk to John Araneta today about his great bodybuilding career and about his great physique and the kind of training he did with Rory Liedelmeyer. And I want to mention that we are brought to you by our sponsor, Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. It's the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe contest in 2012. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner, Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, their two-stage pre-workout, or Vintage Brawn, which is the triple protein isolate powerhouse. It's packed with eggs, milk, and beef protein. Their products have no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners. Old School Labs is also the home of 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banute and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will get 12% off your order when you go to oldschoollabs.com. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, what else is going on in your world, guys? Happy June. It is now the first week of June, and it is getting hotter than ever out here in Tampa. I don't know how the weather is, but you guys have been having crazy weather throughout the United States, of course. I had a busy weekend this last weekend, and that's why the show is going up one day late. Breon Ansley, two-time classic physique Olympia champion, was in town. He was in Tampa, and he was guest posing Saturday night at the MPC Southeastern USA contest, which was held right here in Tampa. Breon is now with Florida Alternative Medicine, the other company that I am with, and they sponsor our podcast here, Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. So they were able to bring Breon in for a guest posing, and man, he looked great. Great posing. He was posing to Chardet, which was great, old school posing. And Breon is looking bigger than ever. He's 205, and I think he has to go down to 180 to compete because they have weight classes. Well, they have weight restrictions for the classic physique. Depending on your height, you have to weigh a certain amount. So I think Breon has to get down like 25 pounds, but he is not fat. He is just big and thick. I was really impressed with how much size he put on. And yesterday, on Sunday, we did a workout at Powerhouse Gym Athletic Club where I train. So I filmed that, and that training video should be up soon on my YouTube channel. And Breon had a great workout. We did back. I trained with him and Tomo, who also works for Florida Alternative Medicine. And Tomo's only about 2 weeks away from competing himself. He's a big guy, probably about 6'2", really great physique, real classic physique. So we all hit back hard. I wasn't even supposed to work out. I just got off work and I only got about 4.5 hours sleep. So I wasn't at my best, but I stayed with Breon on the D-bar rows. We went up to 6 plates, which was pretty heavy. So not bad for an old guy. So we had a great workout. He trains very intense and he's just a great role model for the sport. Great physique. And I predict he's going to win title number 3 this year in Vegas. He really looks good. And I was contacted by criticalbench.com this last week. They want to do a bunch of videos for their amazon.com channel. So we are going to shoot that around the middle of July. So now I have some real incentive to get back on my diet. I've been sort of screwing around my diet the last month or so, but I haven't really made any progress. So now I've really got to get in shape. I got to get a little bit leaner at least for these videos. I don't have to be ripped like I was last year for my photo shoots, but I definitely got to be in better shape. So I got 6 weeks to really buckle down and get in shape before we do these video shoots, which is going to be an all-day shoot. I guess we're going to shoot like 5 videos in one day, so got to be ready for that. There was some controversy this last week. I don't know if it was last week or the week before, where Arnold was at the South Africa Arnold Classic. That was the one where he got kicked in the back from that idiot. But when he did the seminar the day after the contest, he was talking about how bodybuilding needs to have drug testing. So this was all over social media, especially Facebook. And most people were disagreeing with Arnold, saying that he's getting too old and he doesn't know what he's talking about and you can't take the drugs out of bodybuilding. But I think what Arnold was trying to do is get bodybuilding back into the general public's favor again, like it was back in the 70s and the 80s when bodybuilding was getting a lot of mainstream attention on the major networks. And now I think it's gotten so crazy with the physiques being so big. Plus, the difference between now and in the 1970s is the general public is very much aware of what steroids are, where in the 1970s they weren't. Steroids were kind of like a secret in the 1970s. Athletes knew what they were, of course, and even sports writers for the newspapers, they knew what it was, but it wasn't talked about. It wasn't general knowledge where everybody knew about it like it is now. So obviously, when you see a guy weighing 270, 280 pounds on stage ripped, everybody knows that's the result of steroid use, in addition to all the training and dieting and all that stuff that goes into it. So I think that's what Arnold is trying to promote, is we need to do something to get the physiques more aesthetic and where it looks better for the general public so we can get bodybuilding more popular again. It's not about getting into the Olympics, which is what the IFBB is trying to do. And we had our guest on, John Glacione, last week, and he is involved with the IFBB that Rafael Santoya is promoting. And they are trying to get bodybuilding into the Olympics. They're going to start doing more drug testing. So they're going more for that aesthetic look. So it wasn't really about that, I think, that Arnold was talking about. He was just trying to do something with the sport so we can get back to more acceptance by the general public, which he thinks is important, and I do too. So one of the comments that was made from one of the Facebook pages that I saw, some guy said, bodybuilding isn't a sport. And it made me think of the book Pumping Iron, where Charles Gaines, in his literary wisdom that he wrote like no one else could, he had a chapter in Pumping Iron, which I am going to read after we do our John Arnita interview, because I really couldn't find any good articles from the old muscle builders I had to read this week. So my friend Nick just sent me a bunch of old magazines. And one of the things he sent me, he was cleaning out his house because he just moved. One of the things he sent me was a really good copy of the book Pumping Iron, which I already have a copy of the original book, which came out in 1974. I think I bought it in 76. But Nick sent me his copy, and this thing's in really great shape. Mine is getting so old, all the pages are falling out. The binder is getting old, you know, so all the pages are coming out. It's hard to read it. But Nick's book is really perfect. So it made me go back and reread the book this last week, or just go over it. And one of the things that was in there was a great explanation of bodybuilding as a sport and as an art form. And I think nobody could say it better than Charles Gaines. So as soon as we finish our interview with John Arnita this week, I am going to go back and read a section of Pumping Iron that relates to this topic of bodybuilding being a sport. And I think, as I said, nobody could say it better than Charles Gaines. So stay tuned for that. I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. I don't know how many of you out there have read the book Pumping Iron, because it is pretty old. Came out in 1974. And I think it's pretty hard to get a hold of today, even if you go on Amazon or eBay. And might be pretty expensive, because I don't think there's probably too many copies left, especially the original one. So that should be interesting. All right, before we get to our interview with John Arnita, I also want to mention our other sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results that you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number out here in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939. Again, 813-922-8939. But they will work with anybody in the continental United States. Or you can reach them online if that's easier, FLAlternativeMeds.com. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. They'll give you a free consultation, plus they will give you 20% off your order. And they also have a new product called the Magic Pill. It's developed and backed by science. It's a formula that was made by chemists and expert formulators who are working with Florida Alternative Medicine. It's a revolutionary fat-burning product, and it's getting rave reviews from athletes all over the country. So if you order a month's supply of this amazing fat loss pill and thermogenic, it's only $39.99. You can call Florida Alternative Medicine today. Again, that number, 813-922-8939, and order yours. All right. We did not get any emails about the John Colacione interview last week, unfortunately, so I don't have anything to read from that. But if you guys want to send me any emails about this week's show or anything that's on your mind, you can contact me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And if you're listening to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast on Apple iTunes, if you could just go to that page and leave a review, I would really appreciate it, or at least rate the show, because that helps with our ratings, I guess, or our standing in the iTunes community. All right, so that is it. And here is our interview with John Araneta. I hope you guys enjoy this. He was a great bodybuilder from the 1980s. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And my special guest this week is John Araneta. And John was one of the top amateur bodybuilders in the 1980s. He was trained by Rory Liedemeyer, and he was one of the top amateurs during the 1980s, during the very tough 1980s. John, thanks for joining us on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right. I've been a big fan of yours. I used to watch you compete in some of those tough nationals contests that you did. And also, you were the winner in the middleweight class at the Mr. USA. So you had a great career during the 1980s, one of the best eras in bodybuilding.
Yeah, it was tough back then. I mean, I remember nowadays, you know, I looked at the classes and I didn't realize when the class were in Miami and also in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. We were looking at, I think we had, at one point in Miami class, we had like 75 guys in our class.
Wow.
So it was a saving time. A lot of people were doing it, and it was I was glad I was able to, you know, at least make it into the top 10 at that point, you know, and mm-hmm. you know, and take second. But, you know, you always, when you compete, you always want to try to win. So that's,
yeah. Well, let's start from the beginning, John. How did you get involved? Sure. What age were you, and what motivated you to start to try to be a bodybuilder?
Well, I got into bodybuilding actually through football. I was playing football in high school, and
okay.
We did some weight training in the off season my junior year. But then we'd always end up stopping during the season and then continuing back on, you know, after the season was over.
Mm-hmm.
So after my junior year, I sort of kept the weight training going, and I enjoyed it through my football season as a senior. And then kept on going after that. I wanted to play in college just for a year or so. I went to Cal Poly Pomona.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to play football there. But when I got there, things just changed. I decided not to. You know, I only stayed 1 year at Cal Poly Pomona. And I tried to become an architect, but
didn't
work out for that. So I just decided, well, I'll switch schools and go to Cal State LA. But that's basically how I got my start into bodybuilding. I started training every day. And then one day at the gym, the owner of the gym goes, "Hey, you look pretty good. Why don't you compete?"
Mm-hmm.
So I said, "Oh, okay." You know, not knowing anything about it, but that's basically how I got started. You know, it was basically a gym owner saying, "Hey, you look pretty good. Why don't you start competing?" I said, "Okay, you know, I'm that."
Right. Point. What gym did you train at out there, John?
I trained at the gym in Alhambra. I lived in Monterey Park, and I trained at a gym in Alhambra called Jim's Health Club.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was working out there every day, going to school, and that's when he sort of just brought it up. So
okay.
Actually, my very first contest was a natural Mr. USA, or maybe I think it was called Natural Mr. USA, Natural Mr. America, but it was in Las Vegas.
Okay.
Not knowing anything about, you know, training, dieting, I just sort of did my way up what I thought would work.
Mm-hmm.
Competed in that one. I was 18 years old at that point, and I
okay.
ended up taking third in my at that time we had height classes, so I took third in my height class, and I sort of caught the bug and went from there.
So what did you think your physique looked like back then? Could you see you had the genetics for bodybuilding?
You know, not yet at that point. I mean, I thought I had, well, almost maybe I did. I did the small waist, you know, I had
mm-hmm.
pretty good shoulders at the time. I just didn't have the muscle mass I needed.
Yeah.
But I could see the potential, you know, as long as I, you know, put the work into it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know anything about diet or training. And once, you know, I was able to figure that part out and hook up with, you know, with Rory, then I really became knowledgeable on both.
Yeah.
So at that point, then I was able to really accelerate my growth.
So what year did you meet Rory Liedemeyer?
Well, I met him actually. I competed my second show was the Teen Los Angeles.
Okay.
The Teenage Los Angeles, and then I don't know what year that was. That was I think 81.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up taking I think a second in that one. I lost to Doyle Washington, I think, at that point.
Oh yeah, yeah, he was a good bodybuilder.
But I wasn't hard enough. Then basically, so actually, Rory was there guest posing.
Oh, okay.
And I met him backstage, and he actually came to me and said, "Hey, look, I think you have a great potential. I think you sort of both mine and his physique are sort of similar, and you know, because I'd love to train you."
Mm-hmm.
So I said, "Sure." I mean, since I didn't know anything and didn't know what I was doing, I took him up on the offer.
Right.
And when I got 2 weeks after that show was Cal, and basically we just had to drop some weight. So I dropped like I think 6 more pounds.
Uh-huh.
In better shape and end up, you know, winning the Teenage Cal and getting back at you know, Doyle and beating them there. So.
Oh, really? Okay.
but that's how I met Rory. I met Rory at the Teenage Mr. Los Angeles.
Okay.
In 1981. And it was just turned 19 at the time, or 18 at the time.
Now, did you become a training partner, Rory? Were you actually training with him?
Yeah, we did. Actually, right after that, we started training together. So.
Okay.
We trained twice a day, but what I would do is, I would train at Jim's Health Club in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and then I would go train with him in the afternoons. And so we did double workouts, just split a workout.
Wow.
But I always worked out with him. So yeah, we worked out twice a day, 6 days a week together until we sort of went our ways. So up until God, so it was for about the next 3-4 years at that.
Oh,
point.
No kidding! Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So what did you learn from Rory? Because I know he was a pretty legendary bodybuilder. He was one of the top bodybuilders, especially in the California area. And I read about his training in the magazines, how he used to train like a lot of sets, and he would also go really heavy, right?
Yeah, we did a lot. We averaged between 20 to 31 sets a body part.
Yeah, wow.
Because I wrote everything in the book, and then and we trained heavy. You know, that was one thing he told me, because, hey, if you're going to work out with me, because I don't take the weight off, so you better get stronger so that we don't take as much weight off. So,
right.
You know, first period of time, it was tough. I mean, I had to take all the weights off, you know, from my set,
yeah.
And then put the weights back on with him. And
yeah.
I got fairly strong at that point too. I got much stronger over the year to learning that I had to go heavy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and with the diet that he was helping me with, you know, I was able to put some size on, you know,
right.
At that point.
And Rory would get really big too in the off season, wouldn't he? I remember seeing pictures of him.
Yeah.
Bulk up to like almost 300, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess back then, you know, that was the thing to do. I mean, most mm-hmm. guys did it.
Yeah.
So same with me. I mean, when I bulked up, you know, I competed as a middleweight, but I got to in the off season when I was, especially when I wanted to, you know, convert over to the, you know, the men's
mm-hmm.
after teenage years, I'd get up to, I think I was 225, 230 in my biggest.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, we just felt that basically we were heavier, we could train heavy, and the more heavy we lifted, the more muscle we could put on our bodies, and then we just take our time and diet back down. And
yeah.
Back then, there was no cardiovascular work. We didn't do any cardio work. It was just
right,
diet and training.
Right, right.
So we'd start off, you know, sort of 6 months away and plan backwards, you know, so we'd have a good 3 or 4 months of heavy training, and then we'd go back, you know, another 2 months to stay where we're at, get as hard as we could,
mm-hmm.
and then slowly start dieting down, you know, for the show, so we wouldn't lose, you know, too much and lose too much strength at the same time.
Yeah. So when you hooked up with Rory, did you have it in mind that you wanted to be a professional bodybuilder and go all the way to the top?
You know, my dream was basically was to be at the top of the amateur level.
Okay.
The pro level, at that point, I felt that I would do that if I got to that level because I enjoyed it. But mm-hmm. I knew that at that point, there really wasn't any money in it. So you really couldn't make any money from it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I opened up a private training gym when I was 23, when I was younger. Young at that point. So I knew already what I wanted to do. I just wanted my stepping stone, or my goal was basically to be at the top amateur level. And anything after that was bonus. So, but I knew, you know, that at that point that's where I wanted to go. And then that was it. I would be content if I got to that level.
Yeah, you hear everybody today, they always say, I want to be a pro, I want to get my pro card. But if you go back to, you know, 1981, when you were a teenager, there really wasn't much of a pro division. I mean, there wasn't a lot of pro shows.
No, I think at that point, there was probably maybe only 3 or 4 shows
yeah.
you could travel around to.
And the Olympia and the Night of the Champions.
Like $15,000
mm-hmm.
in first place.
Yeah.
So, I mean, really, it wasn't much money. I mean, so to live in a suitcase and travel around, I, you know, reality set in is that that's not the life I wanted to have.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I just, you know, looked at Ford just trying to compete at the amateur level instead.
And the big title back then was the AAU Mr. America, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, at that point, too, it switched from AAU to basically the Nationals, so it was National Bodybuilding Champion.
Right.
So AAU sort of was the beginning part, and that's what we all looked forward to. And then they sort of broke off. AAU kept, you know, the AAU Mr. America, and mm-hmm. the National Bodybuilding or
NPC.
NPC came upon that. And that was, I don't want to say one was better than the other, but the competition was bigger, I thought, at that mm-hmm. time in the National and NPC. Most of the guys went to that. And a lot of the guys were a few of the guys who didn't compete or didn't do well in NPC and go to AU to try to get their titles on that side instead. So I always felt that basically if I was going to compete, I'd go at go to the best level. And if I could do it there, then I'd be satisfied with myself.
Yeah, one thing we skipped over was the Teenage Mr. America in 81, and you went in that and won the middleweight class. So that had to be a big achievement, huh? Winning your class at a national level title.
Yeah, you know, I was happy with that. Again, I wanted to win overall, but, you know, at that point, you know, I went against actually Mike Quinn.
Yeah, Mike Quinn won the overall. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, overall. So I was, you know, I lost, I guess, 6-2 on the votes. And I was disappointed, but I wasn't. I mean, I realized the guy had more mass than I could ever carry as a middleweight at that point.
Right.
So I was happy, but I was also, you know, again, I've always pushed myself to try to be the best I could. And if I was going to compete, you know, at that level, I wanted to win. You know,
yeah.
The division was fine, but then it didn't satisfy my taste, my thirst, you know, for the overall.
Right.
You know, Mike Quinn won. He was bigger. He was thicker. He had more muscle mass on it. And then, you know, and he deserved to win.
Yeah. What was the feedback from the judges and stuff after that, John? Did you feel like you had a really good chance of going all the way to the top at the amateur level?
At that point, yes. Because then, they saw the potential and I saw the potential in me. You know, thicker, refine some areas, and you could really do really well, you know, at your class, you know, at the upper levels. And at that point, again, I was looking at guys I've been looking up to, Charles Glass and Ernie Santiago, and some of the guys were, you know, were older. But when I actually looked at myself in pictures, I could say, okay, you know what? Yeah, I mean, just add a little more muscle mass to your body and you could compete with these guys. I mean, I always feel confident in myself. And again, along with the feedback I got from the judges and from Rory, I was able to be more confident in myself.
Yeah. So you could see you had the shape and the symmetry. You just needed to put on more size.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. That's interesting that you would look at like Charles Glass and Ernie Santiago. You would look at the top middleweights who were at the national level, right?
Yeah, at that point, I was looking at those guys. I mean, I was trying to figure what guys were up top. They were, you know, what kind of physique they had, and what it took to get there. You know, I know they had some years on me. I mean, you know, there was a couple other guys up there that I can't think offhand, but you know, I just knew I needed to build that quality of muscle, that size,
right.
Which is why, you know, I ended up bulking up, going pretty heavy, trying to train heavy.
Yeah,
you know,
after
my teenage years, to try to compete with these guys at that level.
So if you were a middleweight and you got up to 225 in the off season, how many calories were you eating back then? You got to really be packing on the calories, huh? Yeah.
I talk about it now, but it'd be scary. This was my diet, and I kid you not, I'd have a half a pound of red meat in the morning with five mm-hmm. eggs, wheat toast, and fruit. And that was my breakfast.
Okay.
And then lunch, I would have a whole can of tuna and with some bread, try to make a sandwich out of it, but it was tough with the whole can of tuna and three eggs. Lunch was a whole chicken.
Wow.
a whole chicken, a baked potato. And then I would drink a quart of kefir a day.
I remember kefir.
And then mid-afternoon, I had the same thing. I had another can of tuna with some wheat bread and three eggs. Dinner time was a pound of red meat, vegetables, salad, and a cup of rice.
You know,
so I was just trying to feed my body, but it wasn't any fun. I can guarantee that. I literally had to force feed myself. Half the time, it took me longer to eat the food than to make it, just because I didn't try not to throw up as I was eating it.
Unbelievable.
But, you know, I knew that's what it took. You know, mm-hmm. at that time, that's what I felt. That's what it took to really put the size on it and train heavy, you know, so I can train heavy.
Yeah. Now, when you guys were training in the off season, because I noticed here you didn't compete in 82, right? You took off from 81 to 83.
Right. that was from 1990. I told myself I wanted 2 years of good heavy training before I came back and competed, because that's what I felt I needed to put some muscle in my body. So when I turned 21, I felt, okay, I could compete with these guys, at that level.
Unless
I felt comfortable going at that level.
Were you guys still training 6 days a week, or did you cut back on your training when you were trying to bulk up?
No, we still trained 6 days a week.
Wow. Okay.
we just split our body parts up, but we broke it down. We had like chest, front delt, side delt, triceps, forearms, calves, and abs. It was back, traps, rear delt, biceps, forearms again, but different part of the forearms,
And then
the third day was legs, and then we just repeated it, and we took Sunday off. So then we did a different set of body part exercises the other set. So unfortunately, now I sort of pay the price, but it was a lot of heavy wear and tear on the body, back then. We didn't believe in taking them more than a day off. We trained 6 days a week heavy, and then we had Sunday off, and that was it. We're back on Monday again, trained heavy.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned the front and side delt and the rear delt and the traps. I remember that now, reading the articles about how you and Rory trained.
Yeah, we just broke it down to every little body part, even like our forearms or brachialis. Broken down. That we did 10 sets just on that muscle group.
Wow.
And calves, same thing too. Soleus and the gastro. We basically did, one day it was the soleus, one day was the gastro. And we did 10 sets of that.
Wow.
So we did a lot.
So it was just high volume and heavy weight on everything.
Yeah.
Wow. What kind of weights were you using? Do you remember, John? And some of the basic movements?
It was funny. I wasn't as strong on bench as I was on the incline press, but eventually I probably did like 4. I think it was like 455 for one for max on a bench.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Whereas incline, I could do 415 was my max.
Uh-huh.
An incline bench.
That's a lot for a middleweight.
Yeah, I mean, bent over rows, I was doing 315, 365.
Yeah.
With the barbell. Deadlifts was 500. Squats, I did, by most I did squats was 555.
Wow.
For those squats,
heavy weights.
The full squats we did. We just, those are always, I think it was full.
Right, right.
So,
right.
Just crazy weights. I remember doing side raises with up to like 80, 100 pound dumbbells, and stuff like that. And curls too. I was doing 225.
Wow.
245 in the curls, barbell curls.
Yeah.
So everything was heavy, heavy, heavy. I mean, I wouldn't say the best form, but it was heavy.
Right.
Heavy.
Right. Now, when the Nationals started in 82, did you check that show out and see like what the middleweight guys look like in that?
I didn't go to the show. I sort of wanted to exclude myself from anything. I didn't want to see anybody. I didn't want to know what anyone was doing. I just wanted to train heavy and hard.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't want to have to think about anybody else. Only up until the last, really, 3 or 4 months going into 83 did I start seeing who was going to be my competition at that time. I needed to focus on myself. So that's why I took the time off. We trained heavy. I didn't want to look at anybody else. I didn't want to hear the talk and just trained so that way when I came in, I felt I was confident in myself to know that I could hang with these guys.
Yeah. So in 83, you did the California Championships, the MPC California, and you won the middleweight class there.
Right. And then we lost to Mike Christian.
Mike Christian won the overall,
Overall. Again, there I lost again 6-2 that, but that's fine. Mike's a good guy. I like him a lot. Great competitor, it's funny, we talk about it, but back in the day, there wasn't that many guys. There was a few of us. We were kind of like a big family. Though we competed against each other, everybody knew each other because everyone traded goals, and we didn't train goals as much. We'd go down almost every Saturday just to train, just to be around the scene and see everybody and talk to everybody. But everyone got along with each other. There was a lot of camaraderie, and no one was giving us a cold shoulder. Got along great back in the old days. So
it
was fun. To go up there against each other. We wanted to beat each other, but it was a good time.
What was Gold's Gym like back then, back in the early 80s?
God, it seemed like you had the best of the best were there at that time. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're any good throughout the nation, you went to gold and started training there.
Right.
So
right.
You had, you know, God, I mean, anybody at that time was training there at one point or the other. And again, mm-hmm. we'd go on weekends on a Saturday morning. So we'd see a few of the guys, you know, in the morning. But,
yeah,
I mean, you know, again, Christian was there. I remember the Barbarian Brothers were always there. They never competed, but they were
yeah.
strong. You
right,
know,
and, right.
You know, again, Rick Valeni, Charles Glass, of course, was a fixture there.
Yeah.
You know, so, and then some of the guys would pop in for a couple of weeks just to train there, you know, get a look, and then basically they'd be gone, going back home to wherever they lived, you know, another
yeah.
state. So, but it was an exciting time. It really got your adrenaline going, you know, to be in that kind of environment. Because again, back in those days, there really wasn't that much. The environment of bodybuilding wasn't really big. In the Valley or in California, as far as, you know, the multiple of bodybuilders all being in one place at one time. You had a guy, one guy here, one guy there at different gyms, but really when you went to Gold's Gym, there were, God, 10, 20, 30 guys that, you know, that all competed, you know, and all was good.
Yeah. So, yeah, that had to be an incredible atmosphere. I think the first time I went out there was probably in 1990, so I never was out there in the 80s, but man, I hear all the stories about all those guys at one time. And Rick Valente told me, it wasn't that big of a building, you know, so you had everybody in just one building, you know?
Yeah, it was just that the main entrance at that time was it.
So yeah.
That's all you had, you know?
Right.
It was maybe about, I don't know, 6,000 square feet, maybe 8,000 square feet, whatever it was, so.
Yeah.
But it was good because everyone could check each other out, see who weights, it was all about the weight training, heavy lifting, who could lift more, who was heavy that day, depending on what body weight they were doing.
Right.
But it was a friendly competition. You know, we all hang out and talk afterwards. We'd go to the firehouse, eat.
Yeah.
You know, and then, so it was good.
Yeah.
Good time. I
mean, so then you went to the, you did the Nationals that year in 83, and that was a big one. You took third place in the middleweight class in your first Nationals. So that was pretty good. I think it was 20 guys in your class.
Yeah. I was, again, disappointed, but I knew myself, I didn't come in the best shape I thought I could have come in. There were some things at the end with my diet wise that I thought I should have done better and I didn't. So I,
just could have came in sharper, you think?
Yeah. I came in a little flat, put it that way.
Okay. So, okay.
You know, Charles won, he looked great. He was shredded.
Mm-hmm.
And actually I ended up tying for second for, I guess it was, I can't remember the guy's name. Lindsay
McKinney. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he ended up taking me tied for second, but I lost in the tiebreaker, and he ended up taking second. I took third.
So. Oh wow, yeah, and you beat Ernie Santiago too.
Yeah, it was so funny to see these guys that I looked in the magazine. All of a sudden, I was competing against it. So it was a little intimidating, but it wasn't. I felt confident in myself. So again, whenever I compete, I felt, you know, I was there to win. If I didn't win, I was disappointed in myself. So.
And how old were you at that point, John? 21.
21.
Wow, that's fantastic. That was also a real tough heavyweight. I mean, I remember Bob Paris, Roy Liedemeyer, your partner, and then Mike Christian.
Yeah.
And then Hall Gaspari
was the class of the class of Nationals. I mean, that was, everyone was waiting for that, you know, for the heavyweight division to come out. So.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I thought that was the best Rory ever looked, too, that year.
Yeah, he looked good. I mean, the only thing I felt that he could have done was – I don't know, did you go to the prejudging?
No, I just saw it on a video.
At the prejudging, he was a little off, you know.
Okay.
A little water, and that's what I think hurt him. Because the night show, he looked really good at the night show, you know, and I think that's what hurt him a little bit at prejudging. He was just a little bit off. I think he was retaining just a little bit of water.
Yeah.
You know, and so when people saw the night show, they thought, you know, he got ripped off. But I'm, we were training partners, but I just felt, you know, when I saw him prejudging, I thought, oh, I think he's carried a little of water. And, not as sharp as he could have been. And I think he lost like that 2 or 3 pounds of that water and looked really good the following day.
So, okay.
But yeah, it was still close between the three of them, you know.
Yeah.
It was a great show.
Yeah, even today, it's so many years later, but you always look back at that show and you say, wow, what a lineup, man. The guys were so great back then.
Yeah, exactly.
How did Rory feel about that? Was he really disappointed when he got second to Bob?
You know, I'm sure he was. I don't remember, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
I know he was a little bit. I mean, again, he was a competitor also, so he expected to win. I mean, I know that. So anything less than not winning was a disappointment.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I think at that point, then he decided, you know what, okay, get back on the drawing board and be bigger and better next time around, so there is no question.
Right. So how did you feel you looked in 84 then compared to 83? Because you went back into the Nationals in 84, and then it came down between you and John Natoshek.
Correct, yeah. Again, 84, I had changed my diet around.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, at that point, I sort of broke away and started training on my own. I just felt broke away from Rory at that point.
Uh-huh.
It's not that we saw doing things differently. I just felt that at that point it was tough for some to train me when we're competing for the same show.
Yeah.
So I just felt that basically, you know, I need to go on my own and do it my way.
Mm-hmm.
And that way I have no one to blame or no one to help me except for myself.
Right.
So I did things a little bit different. I still kept the training program never changed. The diet did at that point. And I felt better at the 84. Again, I was thicker, I thought, you know, and I was hard. And that's the show. Because I thought, you know, there were so many guys in the show. You know, it was funny. We're backstage, and then I think there were probably 74 guys in our class.
Wow.
And it took over an hour and a half just to do the pre-gen, where each guy went out there for a minute on stage, you know, to go. So basically, you know, everyone went up on stage in two big rows, and then we all went off stage, and then we all had to start all over again and, you know, basically pump up and warm up when you got ready to go on.
Jeez,
and I remember guys backstage, you know, we're talking, and I'll never forget this. We were talking backstage, and somebody goes, oh my God, I hope I make the top 15, because they were only going to get the top 15 right. Back out in pose.
Right.
And then I looked at the guys, and I said, you know, my cousin, I said, are you fucking kidding me? I said, I didn't bust my ass out here so I can make the top 15.
Right.
I'm here to win. That's it. If I don't win, then I'm disappointed. I forget the top, making the top 15.
Right.
You know, the guys are thinking, like, who the hell is this guy? You know, but that's the kind of attitude you needed.
Yeah.
I felt better about myself to get back on track here. I just, again, John was sharper. I thought it was close, but I think I was off again a little bit. I didn't peak it right at that point. So I think I looked better at the night show, but did in the day, prejudging, I was off.
Okay.
You know, and again, it's hard to explain. I don't know what I did. I just knew that basically when it came down to that show, I was off. And again, maybe it was a pound and a half, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Close. Yeah.
Water weight, it just wasn't as sharp. John came in shredded.
Mm-hmm.
So I was disappointed. I was mad. You know, first I took it out on everybody else, and then I realized there's no one else to take it out on. It's your fault. I mean, quit blaming everybody else. Quit blaming the judges. Quit blaming this and that, and realize this is on you.
Mm-hmm.
So after that show, I just said, you know what? I'm not going back in until I feel I'm ready again. I am not going to go back in the show. If I don't think I'm ready, I'm not going to go back in. And that's why I took 85 off or 86 off at the time. And I'm not going to compete again. I'm going to wait till I feel comfortable. Actually, take that back. Sorry, I'm jumping ship. But yeah, sorry. It was 84 was John, and 85 was
Lee Labrada
in Miami.
Yeah,
Labrada. And that one, I didn't come in best shape. That one, I thought was the worst shape of the three shows I had done prior to that.
Oh, really?
Three being Charles Glass, 84 when John winning, me taking second.
Uh huh.
In 85, I thought that was a gift. I felt the judges gave it to me because of my name.
Oh, really? Okay.
I felt I didn't deserve second place at all. I mean, I looked good, but to me in my own head, I knew I wasn't near where I needed to be or I should have been.
Wow.
And
okay.
I was really disappointed in myself in 85. You know, Lee looked great. I thought everybody else looked great. I thought I looked the worst. And maybe I didn't, but in my mind, I felt I did.
Yeah.
And so when he gave me second place, I took the trophy. I said, that's fine. And, you know, I told him, you know, I don't deserve this.
Really? Wow.
You know, I didn't even want it.
Yeah.
Because I thought I didn't deserve it. I felt that basically I cheated myself and I cheated everybody else the way I should have been, the way I should have come. You know,
wow.
And I think, again, I was rough on myself, but I felt that basically I got the show because of my name. They gave me second place because of my name. I said, that sucks.
You know, wow.
And that's when I told myself at that point, I'm not going to do that again.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not going to go in until I was ready.
So you said in 84, you changed your diet a little bit from what you did before. What did you do differently when you were working with Rory compared to what you were doing it on your own?
Roy was more of a, we did more of like a balanced diet.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, cut the calories down a lot. In 84, I changed over. I did the exact same diet Bob Paris was doing at the time. You know,
mm-hmm.
I met Bob and I talked to him a little bit, and he gave me a rough idea what he was doing diet-wise. Again, we all got along well with each other, so there was no competition, you know, especially him being heavyweight, or he was already pro now.
Yeah.
At that point. And he gave me, it's called a 10-day cycle diet. And basically, it's almost what a lot of people do now, but it was depleting. I went 2 days on a balanced diet of like maybe 2,000 calories, 200, not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I did 5 days of just protein, fats only, no carbs. So I depleted my body for 5 days. And then the eighth day, I had a complex carb day. You know, I would have my protein, but I had a lot of complex carbs, you know, beans, rice, baked potatoes.
Okay.
That jumped up to about 3,000 calories. And then the ninth day, I gave myself, it was like a cheat day.
Mm-hmm.
I did what I wanted. And then the 10th day, I went back to a low, very low calorie balanced diet day. And then I just repeated that.
Okay.
So I would start off 100 days out from the show. And I actually worked backwards, but I would start the 100 days out and start doing the 10-day cycle diet.
Hmm.
And as I got closer to the show, I could find out what day I was peaking. Complex carb days, I knew what day I looked my best at.
Yeah, that's great.
So I did that all the way to the show. And so, you know, even, you know, though people were carbing up and so forth, I was on my depleting day, because I knew my second or third day of my depletion day was the best day I looked. After I had my carbs and I had a legit day, I was full, and then I'd go down low-calorie diet and balanced diet for 3 days. By the time fifth day came around, or the second or third day of depleting, but fourth, fifth day of that cycle, that's where I felt I looked my best, and I could time it that way.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, most people do the opposite. They go low carbs in the beginning of the week, and then they carb up.
Yeah, but I felt that worked best for me. Before, though I was off just a little bit, I felt I was full. It was harder at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I liked that diet. But the funny thing is, your body changes all the time. So what I was doing in 84 didn't quite work in 85.
You did the same thing, but it just didn't work the same.
Yeah, I had to do some adjustments here and there, which I tried to do when I ended up competing again in 87.
Okay. So what did you think of Natashek when you saw him? Because he was a new face. Nobody really was aware of him, right?
Yeah, when I saw Natashek, I saw physique that basically he came in great shape all the time. He was shredded.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't necessarily like his physique, symmetry-wise. I thought he lacked a little bit of that. I thought, you know, he at that point, at that time, you know, his waist and shoulders weren't proportion-wise. You know, I thought he was a little lacking in that.
Okay.
And I thought his back wasn't thick a little bit, his upper chest. But, but a lot of it had to do with his structure, you know. But the guy came in shape. The guy was shredded. You know?
Yeah, his abs especially.
One thing, you know, when he came in town, I mean, he came in to peak, he came, you know, prepared.
Right.
So I had to give him that. You know, and then as he got a little older and as he, you know, won, dressed on, he brought those body parts up. But when I was competing against him in 84, I thought he lacked a little bit. I thought I could beat him on the symmetry and proportion. You know, I just didn't come in as shredded as he did.
Right.
And that was that's my fault. That was on me.
And then were you surprised about Labrada the next week or the next year? I mean, because he came from fifth to winning his class.
You know, I was, you know, it's funny. I wasn't really, again, that was probably my lowest point of the three shows I had competed prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was more disappointed in myself. I wasn't prepared, you know, mentally or physically. You know, I went in the show fucked as I had to go in the show. So that's why, you know, I was down on myself and so I didn't really care about anybody else. I was more worried about myself, you know, and then like I said before, you know, when they gave me second place, I just thought, well, that's a gift. I mean, I felt I didn't deserve to be in the top five, you know, I mean.
Really? Wow. Well,
you know, but mentally I was defeated already before I even got into the show.
Yeah.
So I wasn't happy with it. So I don't even remember who, you know, took third, fourth. I don't remember anything about the show. I was
really
so disappointed in myself.
Wow. So you're really hard on yourself, huh, John?
I guess. I mean, I mean, you need to be. I mean, in that sport, mm-hmm. when it's an individual sport, you have to be on yourself. You have no one else to blame but yourself.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I always expected, you know, the best for me. And then when I felt that year, you know, the other 2 years, say 83 and 84, I was off just a little bit here and there. You know, I thought I still could have pulled it off, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. 85, you know, I was nowhere near that. And then, so I was real disappointed in myself.
Yeah.
I didn't come in the best shape that I thought I could come in.
Mm-hmm. So then 86, you took the whole year off, huh? Okay.
Yep. Because I said mentally, I need to take my a year off, refocus, get that drive back that I had before
mm-hmm.
in 83 and 84 and come in ready.
Yeah. So you went to the 87 USA.
Right. And I sort of needed that. I needed the time off. To give myself the drive to come back and be ready, be more prepared. Since I was so off in 85, I felt myself that I needed that time off to do it.
Well, I imagine there's got to be a lot of pressure too. You know, I mean, you're a top guy and you're going to the Nationals, which was the big contest of the year, and you're taking second place. So, I mean, everybody's got to be looking to you as, you know, you're the guy. You know, you have to come through the next year, right?
Yeah, and especially after doing so well the first 2 years. So I guess that pressure I felt, but to me it seemed to me it was more me than mm-hmm. anybody else. I mean, I mm-hmm. felt I put too much pressure on myself, and when it wasn't working, you know, when I wasn't being as strict as I could be on the diet or pushing myself as hard as I could, you know, I had no one to blame but myself.
Yeah,
you know? And that's why I sort of knew going in, you know. You sort of feel confident, but you know in the back of your head that, you know, you didn't give it your all. And I didn't mm-hmm. give my all for the 85. So when it happened and I took second, I said, you know what? That was a gift. I don't deserve it. And I'm not coming back until I'm ready again to compete.
Hmm. So by 87, then you had the drive back. You were ready to do it again.
Correct. Correct.
And then so you decided
the USA.
Yeah, you decided to do the USA, huh?
Well, I was doing the USA first, and I was going to jump in the Nationals after that.
Okay.
But, well, first of all, the USA was actually good. So I felt really confident. I felt good. I mean, I felt everything was back on track.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I felt I had the food, the fullness of the muscle and bellies, but also it was hard at the same time.
Right.
So, and then I had that and that drive. So I was able to do well on that show, you know. So then I think it was I had a month or 6 weeks from the USA, I think, to, I can't remember now, from the USA to the Nationals.
Uh-huh.
And I was going to do the Nationals. But I ended up breaking my hand, and so that was it.
Oh, no way. How'd you break your hand?
Well, you know, when you're dieting, you're not exactly in a good mood most of the time.
Right.
Especially back then when you weren't doing any cardio.
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, it was stupid, but basically, I broke my hand in a fight. I got in a fight.
Oh, really? No kidding.
So, it was over something. It was over, I mean, talk about even being ridiculous. It was over a parking spot.
Yeah,
but you know when you're dieting down, your temper flare is really good. You're short on
the temper, you're not thinking clearly at all, right?
Exactly. Broke my hand with the Cedars. And I didn't realize I broke my hand at the time, but then when I went back to work and training clients, I realized I couldn't use my hand, and I looked at it; it was all swollen up.
So
Cedars. Sure enough, I had three pins put in my hand, and I had cast on for 6 weeks, and that was it.
Oh man, unbelievable.
So, that was the end of not going to the USA and straight into the Nationals, but
yeah.
And again, I have no one to blame but myself. You know, it was, you know, we were dieting down, my temper was short.
Right, and, right.
You know, I'm a fight over a parking spot.
Right.
Let me
take you back to that USA, because you said you thought out of all the shows that we just talked about, that was probably your peak, right? That was probably the best.
Yeah, I thought that was my best at that point because I had to focus again. I went to,
mm-hmm.
I was at 84, I had the focus to do it, and I didn't win. But 87 was just as close, you know, was sort of the same kind of focus and drive
mm-hmm.
I had for that.
How many guys were in your class that year, John? Do you remember?
Oh, I'm trying to remember. I think probably only like 36, I think.
Wow!
Something like that
in
my class.
Crazy competition back then.
Compared to the Nationals, when we were doing, there were 60, 70 guys. But
yeah, yeah.
So, but it was like, I think it was like 36 or 37 guys in my class at that point.
And back then, I mean, if it was done today, you would have got your pro card there. But back then, you had to win the overall. I think that was the first year, I think, right? Yeah. That was the first year that you got the pro card.
First year, exactly, mm-hmm. to get a pro card.
And then Mike Quinn was the one who beat you again. Same thing as a teenage.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Mike looked good that year, too.
Yeah. No, he was heavyweight. He was able to put on more size.
Yeah.
You know, I thought back in 81, when he beat me, he had the upper body thickness, but his legs lacked a little size. But this mm-hmm. time, he brought his legs up, and everything looked great proportion-wise, and then he was able to win.
Yeah, yeah. So after that, you didn't do any more national-level shows then after that, right?
No. Again, that was, 87? So I had basically started my business, my private training business, in 83. So I had that for about 4 years. And I was married. You know, I said, you know what? Again, my goal was not to compete at the pro level. Mm-hmm. I'd already made it up to the national level, and I felt confident at that point. And I said, you know what? That's it. I'm content.
Hmm.
You know, it took me a good, I'm going to say, don't get wrong, it took me a good year or two to get out of that competition mode of training and that feeling. But, you know, I had a business I was working on. We had just gotten married. I wanted to have a kid. We had a house. Mm-hmm. So I had more responsibility at that point when I was younger.
Yeah,
and that was my priority. I felt that basically, the money, you know, I could make, you know, running a business and training people was outweighed, you know, the going pro. Mm-hmm. And don't get me wrong. I mean, I had, you know, back in '87, you know, had Joe Reeder talk to me and everything else, and they wanted to sign me, you know, mm-hmm. to contract. We shot pictures for, oh God, 3 days straight, 8 hours a day of all these different pictures. Wearing his weed. At that point, he had new line of clothes coming out. And
yeah, you know,
I mean, I did every body part exercise wise, you know, but I didn't want to play the game with him. You know, basically, you know, when I saw the contract, you know, he basically owned you.
You know, oh, really?
They didn't want to pay my very much money. I mean, it was, I don't know, at that time, maybe it was like, I don't know, maybe it was $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 a year.
Okay.
You had no health insurance. And mm-hmm. anywhere in a 50-mile square radius area, you had to go. Whether it was at a supermarket, promoting his stuff, you know, on a weekend or a day, you had to go. And that was it.
Right.
And I felt, you know what? I said, I could do better than that. And I own my own self, you know, and
yeah.
my business. I said, well, why would I want to sign myself away for something and do that? And so I turned it down,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I don't want to say I got blackballed, but it just felt all of a sudden those pictures and the covers that were supposed to be there, you know, every couple of months, all of a sudden disappeared.
Mm,
you know,
yeah.
It never happened.
Yeah. You weren't on the team.
I talked to Rick Wayne years ago or mm-hmm. a year or two after that. And he said, yeah, Don, goes basically, you know, cause Rick was working for Joe Weider, and he said, yeah. You didn't sign the contract. That's it. You know, he was going to get other guys going to do it. You know, if you didn't want to do it, someone else would do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, then he did, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, again, I didn't have any, you know, it was my choice.
Mm-hmm.
But it was my choice. I felt that basically it was best for me and my family at the time.
Yeah.
You know, and I was comfortable with that.
What was the personal training business like back then, John? Because back in the early 80s, that had to really just be starting, right? That's when people were doing one-on-one training.
Yeah, I mean, it's something too. I mean, I've had my business now. I've had it for 33 years.
Wow.
But when I first started the private training business, we started in the gym. And I got to say, I was probably one of the – we probably had the first private training gym in L.A., and this is back in 83.
Yeah.
So I was young. There was no certifications at the time. You know, you just basically started training some people.
Mm-hmm.
And had a friend who I met at the gym. He was going to open a private training gym, and it was something new. There was no private training gyms in LA at that time.
Hmm.
And he said, do you want to come with me? Because I was training a couple clients. He was training some clients, and then one other guy was training some clients. And I said, sure, I got nothing to lose. I mean, I'll do this for a little while, buy my time until, you know, I could go to school and get my degree and do something really, you know, really make a living.
Right.
And, so I went with him, and we opened a smaller private training facility. It was like probably 1,200 square feet at the time.
Uh-huh.
And we just started making clients, and the private training, believe it or not, got bigger and bigger. You know, how do we know that we were stepping into something that
yeah.
was not heard of, didn't have it at gyms.
Yeah. There
was only one private training gym that we had that we knew of, which was us in Los uh-huh. Angeles. And it sort of grew from there.
Wow.
And then private training started happening more and more in 85, 86, 87.
Yeah.
We knew everybody because everyone had started through us. So the
right.
trainers that broke off on their own,
uh-huh.
the facilities, it was fine. There was really no competition. And we, you know, again, it was like bodybuilding. We were like a family. We knew each other. So we were mm-hmm. helping each other out, you know, and I had this, we all knew that basically this town was big enough for all of us.
Yeah, there was enough business again, for everybody.
Three or four private training facilities, three or four private training gyms around in our area.
But yeah.
There's enough to go around.
Yeah.
So we could
yeah.
all work together. You know, mm-hmm. and we did. And when I broke away from my partner at that time in 87 and opened up my place, I actually took my clients over to one of the trainers and opened up his own gym, you know, and stayed there for a month while my place was being built.
Wow. That's
so
wild.
You know, again, we knew each other, and there was, again, enough competition to go around for, you know, enough business to go around for everybody. So we didn't really
yeah.
get a competition against each other.
Wow. That's great. So you've been doing it 33 years now, huh, John?
Yeah, I still have a facility. Again, it's gotten a little bigger. I mean, I've
mm-hmm.
really expanded, you know, over the years. But yeah, had it for 33 years now, and now we're 32 years. And now I'm looking at just hopefully another 5 more years, and that's it.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, and you're married, and you got a family and everything?
Yeah, yeah. I have a wife. I've had my wife's same as me. She's been married for 33 years.
Okay.
I have a daughter who's 28 years old right now.
Wow, that's great.
So, life's been good and blessed.
Good, that's great.
Life. Can't complain too much.
And I just talked to Lonnie Tieper a few weeks ago, and he said he gave you some kind of an award, right?
Oh, yeah, I got a, through my high school, I got a Hall of Fame.
Okay,
high
yeah.
Hall of Fame award. So I saw that was last year, actually. I ran into him.
Right.
You know, so he had been pushing me for the last couple of years for my high school to get into the High School Hall of Fame. And finally,
right.
after the second year, we finally got in. So that was fun. It was exciting. It was just a something to be happy about. Again, you know, getting out of training for a while, bodybuilding. It was nice to know that they appreciated the sport I did, and also
yeah.
competing in football and ran track in high school. So
mm-hmm.
it was nice to see some of my old teachers, then coaches that I hadn't seen since I left high school.
So yeah,
it was fun. It was a fun day.
Do you get a chance to see what's going on in bodybuilding now, John? Do you keep up with it?
You know, very little.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I see some of the guys nowadays. I mean, I see some of the physiques nowadays, especially at the pro level. This is not for me. So
mm-hmm.
I the only time I ever go to bodybuilding shows is if I have a trainer or someone I know that's competing, I'll go and support them.
Yeah.
But it's funny. I can go, it's 30 years later, but things never change. The people don't change and the audience doesn't change. And, you know,
yeah.
it's like going through a time warp, but you still see the same kind of attitudes, same people, the way they dress and so forth. And,
right.
And the act,
right.
But, I don't miss it, you know.
Yeah.
Like I said, I don't like where bodybuilding went, and
mm-hmm.
I know they're trying to bring it back now, where they have the classic, you know, bodybuilding physique as opposed
mm-hmm.
to just regular bodybuilding now and so forth.
Yeah.
That's physique again. We all grew up with and enjoyed and liked, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And not that I don't want to take anything away from the guys who are competing in the big shows or, you know, the
mm-hmm.
bodybuilders. It's just, that's just not for me. That's all, you know,
yeah.
It's just not my thing. You know, I like the old classic physique where, you know, they have, you know, the nice V taper, you know, the muscle bellies, you know,
mm-hmm.
my chest is where your chest is bigger than your abdominal cage, you know?
Right. Right.
So, that's
so you think they just got too big and they got away from the whole symmetrical classical look?
Yeah, they just sort of got away from that. It was just math, you know, and
mm-hmm.
you know, size, and just whoever had the biggest size and was cut up won.
Yeah,
so there was no symmetry involved. I mean,
right.
Everybody looks blocky.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, so I once they started going that direction, I just got out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And stop paying attention too much. I mean, I still look at some of the pictures because I still belong to some of the, you know, especially on Facebook, some sites, you know, but I belong to most of the pages are, you know, classic bodybuilding physiques, you know, old school
right.
bodybuilding.
Right.
That's but I appreciate. And it's great to see the old pictures of the guys. It reminds me, you know, some of the guys back in the day, like Serge Dubré, you know, and some of the other physiques. You know, just to see the good symmetry, that size, mass, but, you know, symmetry and proportion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of you right now on my computer from, I think this must be from the 87 USA, and man, your physique looks amazing. And think about how long ago that was. That was over 30 years ago.
Oh, yeah. My body feels it.
Yeah, but what do you think about the posing today, John? Because I know how important the posing was back then, and that's another big complaint about today's bodybuilders is they just don't put enough time into the posing. And, you know, when you look at some of those great routines from back in the 80s and even the 90s, it was just, you know, man, it's just we don't have that anymore.
Yeah, nowadays, I mean, again, you're right. They just basically do one pose after another, one massive, you know, strong pose after another strong pose. And basically that's the look and that's what people are happy with. You know, back then we did take time. I mean, that was the whole thing. You know, we you know, it was not just, we were just preparing for a show. It wasn't just, you know, about diet and looking ready and being ready, but it was also how do you show it? You know, accentuate your body parts that look really good. Hide your smaller body parts or your weaker body parts, you know, but, you know, it was, you know, posing routine was important. I mean, I spent hours.
Yeah.
Routine. Mm-hmm. Hours. You know, I'm talking, you know, starting off 6-8 weeks away, you know, every day.
Right.
So that was
part
of my workout day. You know, it was not just training twice a day. It wasn't just, you know, laying down in the sun, getting a tan. It was, you know, not just doing, you know, the dieting, but also posing.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
And you appreciated the guys that did that. You know, even back in our day, we had some guys who weren't as good as posers, but at least they tried and they did their best.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could appreciate them, you know, for what they did because they put the time and effort into it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was lucky at the time to have, you know, Rory to give me that kind of groove of how to pose. And so I was able to keep that going, you know, later on.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, he instilled that kind of posing routine for me, you know, the fluid motion, the kind of sweeping the legs and the hands, even the fingers, you know. So,
yeah,
you know, it was important, you know, and it should be important as far as, you know, bodybuilding goes, because I think it, you know, you don't think just size them, but it needs the size, symmetry, proportion, shape, and how well you show it.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, like you said, I mean, everybody wanted to do that. Everybody wanted to have a good posing routine, and I competed in the 80s too, and I tell people that, you know, same thing as you did. We practice an hour a day. Probably like 8 weeks out, you'd start getting it together, you know, starting to put your routine together, and then you practice, put it to music. I mean, it was just a really important part. It was almost like in order to have that respect, you had to have a good routine when you got up there, you know?
Exactly. I remember back then, there was no sun. I was in the tanning bed. When I was in the tanning bed, I was going over the posing routine in my head.
Yeah.
The pose. So, I mean, by the time I got on the stage, I mean, it was natural. It didn't feel like you're posing. Everything came out natural. So
yeah. I went back into a contest about 3 years ago, and I did the open class as well as the masters. And I was watching the guy who ended up winning the class, and he came off and he goes, "Yeah, I didn't even know what I was going to do. I just went up there and just started hitting poses." I was like, "Oh man." Totally different from the way it used to be, you know?
Yeah, no one did that. So back in our
day,
that was for sure.
No, mm-mm. All right, John. Well, I appreciate you you joining me on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. It was great to talk to you. I never got a chance to meet you, so I always appreciated your physique when you competed at the top level. And I still think today, even looking back, you still had one of the greatest physiques in the bodybuilding world back then.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you for that. I just, you know, again, it was something I really enjoyed, and because I enjoyed it, I didn't mind putting the work into it.
Yeah,
you know, so, and I knew basically the only one to rely on was myself. So, you know, if I succeeded, I was happy, you know, with myself. Then I know that I gave it all I got, you know, and didn't have to rely on anybody else or anything, or
right,
you know, put in anybody else's hands but mine. So I knew if I put the work in, I could do it myself. So yeah, I mean, I was, you know, again, It was a past life, but you know, I appreciate it, and it gave me a stepping stone to where I'm at now, or what I have now. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I think you definitely made your mark, John, because we still remember your physique, and I think we'll always remember it.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, John. Well, thanks for joining me on the show, and it was great meeting you.
No, same here. Take care.
You too. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to again to our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine, for their sponsorship of this episode. And now, without further ado, I'm going to read a little bit of the book, Pumping Iron. This is an excerpt from the book where the author, Charles Gaines, talks about how bodybuilding can be seen as a sport and as an art form. And I think Charles says it better than anyone ever has. So this was in Chapter 7 of the book Pumping Iron, which was released in 1974. And it reads, if a sport is a physical activity that human beings train for in order to compete at, then bodybuilding is certainly a sport. And yet Sig Klein is right. More importantly and interestingly, it is also an art form. And one of the things that bother the millions who don't know how to look is the confusion over how and where these two meet. Since very few of those people have ever been to a body contest, they have no way to understand how having muscles can be a competitive thing. And since they live in a time when the male body is generally not regarded very highly, and practically never in aesthetic terms, it is just as difficult to imagine how it can be an artistic thing. They are used to sports where the body is a means, not an end in itself. And it seems a feat to a lot of them for a sport to require nothing more of the body than just to be presented for viewing. What are all those muscles good for? I mean, what can those guys do with them are the sort of practical questions you hear. The fact is they can usually do a lot of things with them. That's a fact, but not the point. The point is that the nature of bodybuilding competition is aesthetic rather than athletic. There are other sports where artistic judgments determine the competition, like diving and show riding and figure skating and freestyle skiing. And there are still others like tournament fly casting or skeet shooting, where the skills being tested are as divorced from their practical applications as a bodybuilder's muscles are from the work they can do. Bodybuilding is a little like those sports. In its stylization of movement and concern with ritual, it is also a little like bullfighting. But largely, it is unlike anything else. And to be able to really enjoy it, to learn how to look, if you don't just naturally know how, like the stagette in the bar, it's helpful to begin with a couple of basic suppositions. First, for anyone who would like one, here is a definition. Contest bodybuilding is athletic training of the body for artistic competition. To enjoy or understand it, you need to suppose first that the male body is a potentially beautiful thing, capable of being worked and perfected like a piece of sculpture. And second, that the product of that work can be a serious subject for contemplation and visual enjoyment. These may be unfashionable things to suppose, but they are not at all new. At certain periods of Western history, they were taken for granted. And the two major peaks of our visual culture, the sculpture of 4th and 5th century BC Greece, and the painting and sculpture of the Renaissance, were based on and inspired by a vision of the perfected male body as a single, most articulate and satisfying form in nature. A similar vision, an imagined idea of the potential formal beauty of flesh, lies at the root of bodybuilding, both as sport and as art. From the time some skinny 14-year-old with Terrytons rolled into the sleeve of his t-shirt picks up his first barbell to make his arms a little bigger, until years of training later when, if he's very lucky and good and unsparing with himself, his body might come together in a certain pose and everyone watching will think he's seeing that particular configuration of the human form for the first time ever. From the beginning, a bodybuilder works with himself as a medium in much the same way that Praxiteles or Phidias or Michelangelo worked with bronze and Carrara marble, formalizing and idealizing his material, dispensing with its imperfections, and forcing an idea of it into design. In his work, he is after the same basic qualities of balance and clarity that those artists were after. So it's not surprising that often the result of his work is strikingly like the sculpture and painting of classical and Renaissance artists. The schematized architecture of abdominal, oblique, serratus, and pectoral muscles developed by Polycletus in the 5th century BC, which became so accepted a disposition of those muscles that it served as a model for the cuirass, or the torso piece of armor. It could have been lifted directly off of Franco Colombo. In the Metropolitan Museum, there is a Roman bronze of the Emperor Trebonius Gallus, whose rib cage and thighs look exactly like Mike Katz's. and a Hellenistic statue of the drunken Heracles with the right leg like Ken Waller's, the Farnese Hercules statue in the National Museum of Naples, Michelangelo's figures of God and Adam on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, and his magnificent statue of Day on the tomb of Giuliano di Medici, as well as any other number of works by Hellenistic, Roman, and Renaissance artists, look as though they might have been painted or sculpted using contemporary bodybuilders as models. It's easy to make more out of these kinds of similarities than ought to be made. Franco Colombo has probably never heard of Polykleitos or a cuirass, and I know for a fact that he doesn't think of himself as walking sculpture. The point is that unlike the humanist artist of classical Greece and the Renaissance, he is involved in transforming the human anatomy into an instrument of expression. And that while his training is athletic, more gruelingly so than that of any other sport except for maybe long-distance running, the product of it is not a speed or a skill, but his own body, reorganized and rendered into something which has to be looked at and evaluated aesthetically to be appreciated, and which should be able to provide at least as much pleasure when studied that way as a piece of marble 25 centuries old that resembles it. The problem for a lot of people in taking that pleasure, of course, has to do with the fact that Franco is made out of flesh, a stuff that pulls at our most intimate emotions and memories in a way that marble can't. These humanist artists, after all, weren't really sculpting or painting men, but man, right? At times in history when people believed in him, showing him muscular with dignity, achievement, and the possibilities of the species, it was all sort of symbolic. And looking at that kind of thing is a damn sight different than looking at some rakish, beefed up ex-bricklayer Sardinian. God, those guys are gross. I mean, God, she said. She was a secretary at the William Morris Agency in New York City, and she was looking through a stack of Butler's photographs, which he had asked to see, turning them over one by one with a single 2-inch fingernail as though they might be infected. We had been on this route before, and we knew the lines. Why are they gross? Do they really look like this? I mean, that's just, well, how about sculpture? How about those Greek and Roman statues at the Metropolitan with all the muscles? That's different. That's art. She finished the stack, sighed. Art ain't human. Maybe not, but I can think of a number of times when it was very hard to tell the difference between them. Like one hot Sunday afternoon at the Mountain Park Amusement Center in Holyoke, Massachusetts. Outside the auditorium, or pavilion as it is called, a roller coaster clattered up and down a wooden trestle. Children flew around on little whirly things that looked like boats with wings. There were clam bars, pizza stands, dart throws, cotton candy booths, and a commando machine gun stall. Inside, on the stage in front of 1,200 people, Leon Brown, a black laundry worker from Staten Island, was posing for the 1972 Mr. East Coast title. He had come on stage in a high-chested glide, his mouth a little ajar, his eyes flat with concentration, and he stared for a long moment into the rear of the huge auditorium, as if somebody back there were trying to teach him canasta. Then he found whatever it is he was looking for, and he began a routine that was right on top of perfect. Somewhere toward the middle of it, he slid into a back pose and he jiggled it tense. Trapezius, deltoid, infraspinatus, lats, all the workhorse muscles of the back, coming together suddenly like the click of a box and gleaming above his white posing trunks like oiled chocolate in perfect organized mounds. It was the kind of pose that a bodybuilder finds only once in a while, when everything is right and he reaches for it and hauls it down and all the muscles fall into place like gears meshing. For the people in that audience, it was like seeing Leon get hit by lightning. Learning how to look at bodybuilding is probably no more than learning how to be objective and unembarrassed about the body. Enough so that you could look at that back pose of Leon's without wondering about what makes him do it, or how it smells up there, or what his sex life is like. And just go along with the visual thrill of seeing something brilliant and uniquely expressive done with the human form. Few things are more fascinating or moving to human beings than bodies. We all have one and we covet others. We look to them for pleasure and gratification, for sensory information, for protection and flight and communication. We stare at them, fondle them, make love to and with them, develop fetishes about them, indulge them, ponder them. And at some point, we all, every mother, son, or daughter of us, care about how ours looks. Furthermore, most of us care in a cheerfully platonic way. Granting, every time we notice that we are too fat or have good calves, the existence somewhere of an ideal waistline, an ideal calf. Given the fascination and the inclination to idealize, it should be perfectly natural for people to find interest in bodies that have been developed and worked as far as the medium of flesh will allow, that are not only bodies but symbols, every bit as universal and articulate as carved marble or bronze, of our physical potential and limitation. It should be, and in Asia, the Middle East, and parts of Europe, places where bodybuilding is vastly more popular than it is here, it seems to be very natural indeed. Perhaps it would be in America, too, where almost all the best bodybuilders are, if it were not for the fact that bodybuilding over here has seemed determined to keep itself a secret. Ever since Sandow hung up his leotards, the internals of the sport seem to have conspired to keep this one simple truth from getting out. For whatever reasons, a physique competition is fun to look at. And at its best, when the show is right, when the posing routine is being laid down exactly right by a first-class bodybuilder who has everything together, it can be something else as well. Then you don't have to be reminded of Phidias or any of those people who swear to you you're watching something very much like art. All right. That is a great, great book, Pumping Iron, if you ever get a chance to read it. As I said, no one puts it together in writing like Charles Gaines. All right. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Next week, we'll be joined by bodybuilder Skip Robinson, who was a top amateur bodybuilder in the 1970s. And thank you again to Florida Alternative Medicine and Old School Labs for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Please leave us a review on iTunes. And if you have any questions or emails, please send them to me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. See you guys next week. Take care, everybody.